follow.
Welcome to the Mighty Eighth podcast, the podcast about the people, planes and the places of the United States 8th Army Air Force during World War II. With me, Johan Tasker, military historian Mike Peters and very special podcast guest Sophie Green. This episode is about the first American bombing mission over Berlin in broad daylight 80 years ago on March the 4th, 1944. We're at the home of the 95th Bomb Group, who conducted that raid, and we're here to find out why they carried on with that mission despite a recall order which saw other planes turn back. We're at the Red Feather Club, the 95th Bomb Group Museum, about 80 miles northeast of London in the county of Suffolk. Mike, the 95th was the only 8th Air Force Bomb Group to receive the Distinguished Unit Citation three times, more than any other bomb group, and not just for that first Berlin mission.
That's right, Johan, and it's a remarkable achievement. And each bomb group has its own story to tell, and it's definitely its own character. And certainly the 95th is a remarkable story. They're a very special bomb group. The Distinguished Unit Citation is awarded to uniformed military units of the United States and its allies for extraordinary heroism in action against an armed enemy. So it can only be earned in battle. It was established by President Roosevelt after the attack on Pearl Harbor, which obviously brought America into World War II. The unit that's awarded that citation has to do something exceptional. It's rather like the old British system of the battle honor, and it does single you out amongst your peers as for an individual or remarkable action. And most units might get one, possibly get two. To get three is extraordinary, and the 95th, I think when you read through the history, absolutely deserved all three.
And today we know the Distinguished Unit Citation as the Presidential Unit Citation. It was renamed in 1957. And as you say, Mike, to win it once is an achievement in itself, but to win it three times is nothing really short of incredible. Sophie Green, you're our special podcast guest for this episode. You're also curator here at the Red Feather Club. What were those three Distinguished Unit Citations for?
The first unit citation was for maintaining tight defensive flying formation despite the severe assault by enemy fighters while bombing the aircraft assembly plant at Regensburg on August 17th, 1943. The second was very similar for maintaining a tight formation despite concentrated attacks by fighters and intense anti-aircraft fire while bombing the rail marshalling yards at Munster, only about 2 months on from that missions at Regensburg. But that third citation was for our Berlin mission, which is what we're here to talk about. The first daylight raid on the German capital of the war, and that took place on March the 4th, 1944.
So, Mike, we talked before about how difficult it was to fly in a tight formation, and to do that in combat conditions was even more difficult.
Yes, it is. I mean, all those variables we've talked about before, the weather, turbulence, cloud, etc. There's flak, obviously enemy fighter action. All those things to contend with, but actually just physically holding a formation in those conditions takes a lot of doing, and not all bomb groups were good at it. Those that get taken apart by, or their formation gets picked apart by enemy fighters is generally because they're holding a loose formation in the first place, because they're not as skilled at it. And certainly we've talked about this with the 381st, we talked about the 100th, and now we're talking about the 95th. The 95th were a very well-disciplined and well-led bomb group, and that comes through in their performance. So they deserve these citations, and holding that formation is critical to defence and absolutely critical to your bombing pattern as well.
And Sophie, the Red Feather Club here at Horam, United States Army Air Force Station 119, the Red Feather Club here is a living museum and monument to that bravery, to the heroism of the 95th Bomb Group.
Yes, so this museum is quite unique. It's housed within the original enlisted men's club on base. The main part of the museum consists of three large Nissen huts, two of which are the original, one has been rebuilt. And we operate here. We've got a fully licensed bar in the original location of the bar, known as Brad's Bar, named after the chap that ran it here during the war. And we've got lounge areas, we've got a large dance hall, and then obviously the main museum as well.
And the Red Feather Club, how did it get its name?
And so the Red Feather Club comes from the unit's logo that they carried, which is essentially, it's a blue shield with a white cross and a red feather in it. The shield is the shield of Justin. The white cross is the St. Justinian cross. And then the red feather is the ancient Red Indian sign for bravery. And that's where they got the red feather from, is the, from their logo.
And at no time, perhaps, more brave than on that Berlin mission on the 4th of March, 1944. We're here almost 80 years to the day from that mission. It's cold. It's a blustery March morning. It's raining. Let's go inside and take a closer look at the museum itself.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
You're listening to the Mighty Eighth podcast, a podcast about the people, planes and places of the United States 8th Army Air Force during World War II. In this episode, we're at the 95th Bomb Group Museum, and we're talking about the first American bombing raid over Berlin. Sophie, we've come now into the museum, the main part of the museum. What can we see here?
So in here, we are surrounded by all of our exhibits. Every single exhibit in this museum is 95th. We don't have anything from any other group or any other force. So every button, every jacket, every piece of paper you see in here originates from this base.
And if we look around, we can see the names of the bomb squadrons above various glass cabinets containing uniforms, memorabilia, models of planes, photographs. We've got the 334th, the 335th, the 336th and the 412th.
Yes, so that was our four squadrons within our group. The museum is separated up into the squadrons, so each collection is kept together according to the squadrons that they belong to. So everyone, when they look, they can see that, you know, each group of cabinets belongs to a certain squadron.
Dedicated to the 95th, so every tail fin that you can see here on the pictures and the photographs of the planes is a square B.
Yes, our famous square B. Our counterparts in the rest of the combat wing, you had the 100th with the famous square D and the 390th with the square J. And obviously the square signifies which air division they belong to. So we're 3rd Air Division, 13th Combat Wing. So we our B-17s carried the square. And the B is signifying the 95th Bomb Group. So then in formation, you can see which planes are yours and which planes belong to other groups.
Mike, destination Berlin, target Berlin, the German capital and the ultimate objective. Explain, if you will.
It's always been an aspiration to hit Berlin. And psychologically, it's a hugely important thing. If you can demonstrate the fact that you can reach into an enemy territory and hit the capital. And that's what they're going to try and do. And they tried to do this as early as November of 1943, but the weather is against them. We've talked about the weather in the autumn and the winter of 1943 before and the effect that has on the 8th Air Force daylight offensive. It's a real showstopper, literally. And we're at a point now where they're going to go and try and do that again in March 1944. And this is all linked to Point Blank, Operation Point Blank, which is to enable overlord D-Day, Normandy, to allow that to happen. And to, in order to do that, the Allies must have air supremacy, not air superiority, air supremacy, to get across the channels and get those land forces ashore. And an integral part of that is this bombing offensive and hitting targets. And what's changed about the way that the US Army Air Force is going about this is rather than hit targets on the ground, it's to bring the Luftwaffe to battle, to destroy the Luftwaffe in the air and on the ground. And if there's one way that you can surely bring the Luftwaffe to battle, it is to go for Berlin, to stick the stick in the ant's nest and provoke a reaction. And there's no way that the German High Command can ignore attacks on Berlin, and particularly daylight attacks. It's very significant.
So rather than just destroying the aircraft factories, the ball bearing plants on the ground, the infrastructure, they're tempting the Luftwaffe into the sky and destroying them directly there.
It's a twofold plan, you're right. Go for those targets, obviously, particularly oil and transport and the things that they do over the course of the year. But it's all linked to the overall objective of Operation Overlord and getting troops ashore from UK across onto the European mainland. And this is going to play a big part in that. So to provoke the Luftwaffe into a battle, a war of attrition, then you've got to go for those targets. But if you go for Berlin, you really are guaranteed to get a reaction.
And we described this as the first American daylight bombing mission over the German capital, and it was. But Berlin had been bombed before by the Brits.
Oh, absolutely. The Royal Air Force have been hitting Berlin right from a very early point in the war after Luftwaffe bombers have bombed London, and it's gone on all the way through. So the RAF have been visiting Berlin for years. But yeah, it's a regular feature of life if you're a Berlin citizen. Bomber Command comes to see you quite often.
So the Brits have been bombing at night for years, but this is a completely different proposition, daylight precision bombing. And if any bomb group had the capability and experience of being able to pull this off, it would be the 95th. Sophie, this wasn't a rookie bomb group who had just arrived in the UK. The 95th were battle-hardened and experienced.
Yeah, so the 95th were part of the 13th Combat Wing. They were the first of the three groups to arrive here in the UK. And doing that, we flew more missions than our counterparts, the 100th Bomb Group, the famous 100th Bomb Group, and then 390th. We might have flown more missions, but we actually suffered less losses than the other two groups as well. So it just goes to show that the discipline that was drummed into the guys of the 95th really was paying off. And they were doing their job incredibly effectively.
And Mike, that discipline was really, really important.
It's critical. And if you look, if you flip the coin around, look at the other side, if you're the Luftwaffe pilot and you're cruising up and down a stream of 50 or 60 miles of bombers and combat box formations, you're looking for the loose formation. You're looking for just a chink in the armour and a lack of discipline. And that's what they go for, you know. So the groups that don't do so well and take higher casualties, that's generally why. It can be where you are in a formation, as guys who talk about the 100th do, talk about being bottom and at the rear and all that sort of thing, but also it's how your formation is performing and how it looks. That's how they do that, and that is down to the commander who raises the group and brings them over, and how discipline is maintained. And in this case here, it's Colonel Aaron Kessler, who has a reputation amongst the guys from the 95th of being a very firm but fair disciplinarian and a professional soldier who wants them to do everything they do and do it properly. And other bomb groups don't have that. And if you're growing a bomb group from scratch, which is what all of these bomb groups are pretty much doing, then the personality and drive and the way that this commander builds a bomb group is absolutely critical. And I'd argue that looking at the 95th and their route to get here as they develop and how they end up here, I'd say that is the deciding factor.
The route to get here, it's not just a different philosophy, it's a different physical route as well. We often think of B-17s and B-24 bombers are coming across island hopping almost from North America to the UK, Newfoundland, Greenland, Iceland, Scotland, and then to the east of England. The 95th, they came across by what we refer to as the southern route.
Yeah, they did. And it's worth, we've not talked about this before, so it's worth doing it in a little bit of detail. Obviously, all these bomb groups are raised and form and train in the United States, in different parts of the United States. And one of the things that the 95th veterans talk about is they spend a lot of time in South Dakota, in snow, exposed, and have quite a tough time in their initial training months. But when they sort of move their way across the United States to cross the Atlantic. Their flight across the United States is used as a training mission as well. And all the bomb groups do this because they've not flown really long-legged missions before. So actually getting to the UK is still on-the-job training almost. When they leave the United States, they do some overwater training on the way. So from Gulfport, Mississippi, to Morrison Field, which is West Palm Beach in Florida. So they cross that bit of water there just to get some experience of navigating across water, which is a very different proposition from flying over land. There's no reference point. It's all done on time and distance and headings, etc., and wind direction is critical. The second leg then goes from Morrison Field to Borinquen in Puerto Rico. So they're heading south. And then they go from there, they take off again and go from south to Atkinson Field in British Guyana. And then they carry on heading south to Belém in Brazil. And then further down into Brazil, heading southeast now to Natal, Brazil. And then they set themselves up there and rest there and pause and service ready to cross the South Atlantic, which is quite a remarkable thing. They're going to cross the South Atlantic in the dark. They take off in darkness to head across the South Atlantic, which is a perilous journey at the best of times. And 1940s aircraft are not super reliable, as we know. So they launch into the dark for a night flight across the Atlantic, and leaving Natal and crossing the South Atlantic to Dakar in Senegal on the West African coast. Having replenished and set themselves up again there, they're still nowhere near UK. They're now going to turn northwest and fly to Marrakesh in Morocco. And next, they've got the most dangerous leg of the flight, and that's into Europe from Marrakesh. So they've got to get across the Bay of Biscay, which is routinely patrolled by German Junker 88 twin-engine fighters, which are quite formidable, and Focke-Wulf Condors. And German U-boats hang around in the Biscay, can report your headings and times, etc. So they're going to do that. And if they run that gauntlet safely, they're then going to make landfall at the most southern west southwestern point of UK in the county of Cornwall at St Ival and land there. They've actually made it at that point to UK, to Blighty. That is the southern route.
The southern route then from the United States to Puerto Rico to Brazil, to Senegal in Africa, to Morocco in North Africa, across the Bay of Biscay to Cornwall in southwest England. A very, very different route to the northern route across via Greenland and Iceland.
Yeah, and one of the points to make about this is navigators. You need navigators to do this. There's no digital aids to do this, no satellite navigation. This is all done by time and distance and headings. And the 95th are loaned a very good navigator from US Air Transport Command who leads the formation to get them over there. And he's, in all the accounts you read from the 95th crews, they praise this guy because he's absolutely on the money all of the way. But, you know, think about that. Taking off in darkness in a World War II vintage aircraft to fly across the South Atlantic is something else when you've not done that before. This is the first time you've done it. It's quite a remarkable thing to do.
So, Sophie, we think about the 95th being associated with Horam or Horam, but there's more to it than that. They weren't always based here, at least not initially.
No, so when the 95th first arrived in the UK, the base here wasn't yet ready for them. It was still being built. So initially, they spent the first few weeks over at Alconbury in Cambridgeshire. And then after that, they were then moved on to a nearby base at Framlingham, which is more famously known as the home of the 390th. And that is where Horam would fly their first, or the 95th would fly their first missions from Framlingham. So they were there again, and they didn't arrive here at Horam itself until the end of June 1943.
And Sophie, when they finally arrived here at Horam, it would have been very different to what they were used to back home.
Oh yeah, definitely. This part of England is so, so rural. And especially at that point, you know, the village of Horam itself had very few people living in it. And all of a sudden you have this big airfield slapped upon it, 3,000 men suddenly turn up. And these bases were primitive. These guys were living in tin huts, you know, especially on a day like today where it's windy, it's cold, it's raining, really, really quite unpleasant. You had the little potbelly stoves if you could get coal to fuel them. So, you know, finding any kind of warmth was really, really, really difficult. Like I say, we are rural. The nearest big towns, Ipswich or Norwich, 30 miles each way. So there was no just popping into town or anything. You know, it was a big upheaval. You had to get there to get the train everywhere practically, because there was nowhere close by for them to go and experience social life. You know, the nearest town of any kind of relevance would be Diss. But again, that would only be a handful of pubs and shops and really not a lot else more.
Very different then, as we've said, from home. But there were big attempts to make it a home from home. Some home comforts, some home entertainment.
Oh, yes, definitely. Each base was practically like a self-contained town, so they had everything they could possibly need without having to leave the base. They had, as we have here, the enlisted men's club. The officers had their equivalent as well. Red Cross Club as well, cinemas, theatres, chapels, everything that they could possibly need to keep them entertained here.
And the Red Feather Club was famous for its Blue Lounge, its dance hall. And we can go into the Blue Lounge today and see exactly what it was like in 1944, around the time of the raid over Berlin. Let's go and take a look.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So here we are in the Blue Lounge. You can see why it's called the Blue Lounge, because it really is blue.
Yes. So when the property was purchased back in 1981, this building sadly was long gone and all that was left was its concrete base. So in around 2005, when they decided they were going to rebuild this, a lot of original photos were in existence, thankfully, so that they could rebuild this exactly to how it was during the Second World War, including the signature fireplaces at either end, and also tales from veterans, thankfully, telling us what colour it was inside. And obviously it was called the Blue Lounge for a reason.
And you talk about the concrete base for this, the Blue Lounge. No concrete base in evidence here. This looks like a very, very expensive wooden sprung floor, ideal for dancing.
Oh, yes, definitely. Quite a few people will say it's the best dance floor in the east of England. Takes a lot of maintaining, but it's very, very popular with dancers. We hold regular dancers here, sort of 40s and 50s dances, exactly as they would during the Second World War. This was a very, very popular destination for locals to come, as well as the young men that were on this base.
Very popular then, very popular now, very, very much a living museum.
It is literally on a dance night. When you step in here, that atmosphere just comes alive, especially if you've got a group of young men in uniform stood at that bar. It is like you were stood there in 1944.
So we've got the two fireplaces, the two brick fireplaces at either end, the Stars and Stripes and the Union Jack flag at one end, and at the other end we've got the Stars and Stripes, and there's another flag next to it, Sophie.
Yes, so that's our what we call our group colours. Every group would have had one, and we've got all the separate ribbons on there telling us of the different battles that the group fought with. Ours has been recreated for us. We take it to church every couple of years, and it gets re-blessed every few years as well.
The Blue Lounge then, the dance hall here at the Red Feather Club, would have seen some great evenings, some great nights during the war, people letting their hair down, having fun, but also people perhaps drowning their sorrows, decompressing after some particularly difficult raids. We've spoken about the discipline of the 95th, Mike, but it wasn't always plain sailing. They had a particularly nasty baptism of fire, the Kiel Raid in June 1943.
Yes, up until June 1943, they'd had quite a steady baptism or inoculation, as you might want to put it, of a series of missions. They'd flown eight missions. They'd only lost four aircraft. They'd bombed targets like Saint-Omer on the French coast. They had been to Emden and bombed Emden on the German coast and a couple of targets in Belgium. So what would then have been categorised as milk runs, fairly safe missions to fly. They'd only lost four aircraft in that process, and they claimed a large number of German fighters shot down. So confidence was steadily building, and if you were in the 95th at that point, you'd have been pretty pleased that the first eight missions had gone that well. Things are quite tough for them on the ground. They're at Alconbury, then they're at Framlingham. Neither airfield really suits their purposes, but they've still got to fly and do their stuff. So they're getting ready for a bit more of a testing mission, and that's going to come their way in the shape of this mission to bomb really the German Navy's main base at Kiel. So it's accordingly, it's quite well defended with fighter cover and anti-aircraft defences, which is sounds straightforward because it's on the coast. It's not penetrating deep into Germany, but the problem is if you approach a target over water, you're quite easily picked up by radar. So the Germans are going to know they're coming quite a way out.
And the 95th, they decided to do this in a somewhat unconventional way.
Well, they didn't decide that. Brigadier General Nathan Bedford Forrest III decided that this would be a good idea. And he's at 13 Combat Wing Headquarters, and he's a career soldier. Don't get me wrong. This man is not an idiot, but he's got some quite radical views on how things should be done. And he's not totally enamoured or a fan of the combat box formation, which had been advocated by Colonel Curtis LeMay at the time, which most people see as the optimum way for a formation of B-17s or B-24s to defend themselves from fighter attack by interlocking arcs of fire, collective defence and a tight formation, which is also better for bombing as well. Forrest doesn't see it that way. Forrest thinks that this tight formation is masking the use of some of the guns because the friendly aircraft are in the way, and he advocates they are box formations, but they're spread out in a much flatter formation. They're not stacked. And he thinks that this will allow more turrets to bear, more guns to be brought into action, and more of the bombers to... An increase in firepower is what he sees it as. He's probably the only person in the combat wing who thinks that way, but he's the commander, and he's decided that they were going to trial this during the Kiel mission.
So rather than trialling it on a milk run, on an easy mission, they're going to trial it in the face of some determined German opposition.
Yeah, he's not just throwing them into this. They've been training for 2 weeks, flying this formation over England and practicing and doing drills and trying different ways of doing it. And they've done it in the classroom, etc. So it's not a half-baked idea. He's theorised he believes in this, and he is probably the only person who does think this is the way ahead, but he's the one-star general and he's given the order, so everyone's going to do it. And it probably, in hindsight, isn't the best time to do it over a heavily defended target like Kiel.
And what happens?
Rather predictably, the wing sets off to bomb Kiel, form up a splasher 6, the beacon outside Dis, turn out towards the North Sea and head to the Baltic. On the way out there, pretty uneventful. A couple of aircraft turn back with engine problems, as is normal. But it's as they approach the coast, almost as soon as they see the German coast, most of the witnesses who survived the raid say that the sky became alive with German fighters and the flak was very intense. And for 15 minutes, as they made their way in to the IP, into the bomb run, onto the shipyards, the sky was absolutely full of German fighters. And there was a very, very intense air battle raging. They carried on, they pressed onto the target. Forrest was in the lead aircraft. This is not a backseat general. This guy is in the front aircraft, right ahead of the formation. And as he comes out of the bomb run, his aircraft is hit and starts to go down in flames. The order is given to bail out. There are 13 people on that aircraft because it's got extra people on because it's the command aircraft. They all bail out and are seen to leave the aircraft, but they drown. All bar one. There's only one survivor from that aircraft. The raid carries on without him. Obviously, everyone sees him go down with his aircraft. And the formation returns back to UK under attack initially, then they back across the North Sea they come. Colonel Aaron Kessler, who's in charge of the 95th, who's the commanding officer, has a very dark night, literally, that night, because he, once he gets the butcher's bill, he's lost 10 fortresses from the 95th. So when you think about the fact they've only lost four over those eight missions, now he's lost 10 fortresses in one mission and 102 people listed as killed or missing in action. So it's quite a somber mood. And it's interesting to note that night when they're slated to fly again the next day on another mission. And once they take stock of the damaged aircraft they've got that have made it back to the 95th airfield, they realise they can only put one aircraft in the air the next morning. Curtis LeMay calls Kessler and says, I see you're slated to fly tomorrow. And he says, yeah, but I've only got one aircraft. He said, I'm going to come and fly with you. I'm going to fly with you and get the 95th back in the air. Luckily, that mission is cancelled and doesn't happen, and the bomb group can begin the process under Kessler of reconstituting new aircraft, new crews, and building itself. So that's a really, really stark lesson to learn, 10 B-17s in one mission. When everyone talks about the 100th and Rosie Rosenthal, but, you know, this is the same combat wing just down the road earlier, obviously, but losing 10 in one go.
And a stark illustration too, Sophie, of the importance of places like the Blue Lounge here at the Red Feather Club in maintaining morale, in keeping people's spirits up.
Oh, absolutely. These places were absolutely vital to these young men and their well-being and their mental health. You know, they got this place, they got the Red Cross Club as well, on just across the way on one of the other accommodation sites. And between the two places, it gave them somewhere to come, somewhere to relax, somewhere that reminded them of home. Familiar faces behind the bar, you've got the Red Cross girls at the Red Cross Club, you know, whether they wanted to come here and have a drink to drown their sorrows or whether they wanted to go to the Red Cross Club and write home or listen to some music or just play some pool, you know, they had those options available, and they were absolutely crucial to, you know, the morale of these young men and helping them to continue with their missions that they had to do.
Well, Sophie, this is an absolutely fantastic dance hall, and I do hope Mike and I can come back when there is a dance here and find out a little bit more about it, about the music and the people and the Red Cross Club too. But for now, let's go out to the runway and talk about that Berlin mission on the 4th of March, 1944. You're listening to the Mighty Eighth podcast, the podcast about the people, planes and the places of the United States 8th Army Air Force during World War II. In this episode, we're talking about the first American daylight bombing raid over Berlin. And we've come now to the start of the runway here at Horum. Mike, it's obviously not used. The main runway's not used anymore. It's weeds growing through the concrete. There are puddles. There are potholes. It looks very much like it could be in 12 o'clock high, the film.
It has got that vibe, hasn't it? If it was in monochrome, you'd certainly think you were in the film, because, you know, it's so close to the village. It's full width. You've got that length, and you can see that little windsock at the end. You can almost hear the B-17s cranking up, ready to go on a mission, can't you? It's phenomenal.
Mike, the first daylight raid over Berlin almost didn't happen.
That's true. I mean, there had been an aspiration to hit Berlin as early as November 1943. And Field Order 477 was issued for a daylight raid on Berlin in March of 1944, as we know. And the original date for it was the 3rd of March. That had to be postponed because of very bad weather and high cloud. And high cloud sounds like a silly thing to say, but when they climbed out of the airfields to form up, they realised quite quickly that the cloud was above the bombing altitude. So that they... and forming a tight formation in cloud is not really going to happen. So more than once that happens, and also there are problems with the weather which lead to delays, which means that the fuel is consumed, there's not enough fuel to get to the target, and also oxygen levels are low on the aircraft. So this is not the first attempt, but when they do it, it's going to be on March the 4th. It's going to happen, which is what we're about to talk about. But it's just worth bearing in mind, this is not the first time they've tried to do this.
And this wasn't area bombing, this wasn't an RAF tactic, this was precision daylight bombing. What was the target?
Well, the target was the Robert Bosch AG factory in the Kleiner Machnow suburb on the west side of Berlin. Berlin's not a hugely industrial target, so when you take the American doctrine and say we're just going to hit military targets, there are plenty around Berlin, but it's not like bombing the Ruhr or hitting a U-boat pen. So you do need to be quite precise, and that's what, again, where the weather comes into it. You need to be able to see the target with a Norden bombsight, although there will be a radar-equipped Pathfinder aircraft from Alconbury joining the formation to bomb through cloud if they have to. So accuracy is still very much in mind, but they're going to try and hit. It's going to be 500 aircraft, and the total aircraft, including fighters, etc., is going to be almost 850 forming up to punch a way through to the German capital.
And a dual-purpose mission. They're going to target this factory, but they're also going to be bringing the Luftwaffe, the fighters, into combat so they can take them down and take them out of the sky.
Yeah, because we're at a point now where we've got the P-51. where we can do that, and the P-51 can go all the way to Berlin. And if the Germans are going to defend one place, it's going to be Berlin. And you know, Hermann Göring said that nobody'd ever fly over Berlin. Well, the RAF have been doing it for years, but the US Army Air Force are about to do it in broad daylight, which is a massive propaganda and psychological blow against the Germans.
So, Sophie, what's happening on the morning of the 4th of March?
So the 1st and 3rd Air Divisions are forming up ready to hit the target, which is obviously for that day was Berlin. But unfortunately, the cloud cover was quite dense, and obviously forming up in cloud is extremely difficult and obviously very, very dangerous as well. So trying to form up as best they could with low visibility.
So low visibility, Mike. We always talk about the weather being a problem in this podcast, on the Mighty Eighth podcast, and today was no exception.
Yeah, the airfields that most people are taking off from have got snowstorms and sleet. Those aircraft that do get away, when they start to formate over the beacons ready to go across, they realise that the cloud is still up at 29,000 feet, so they're going to have to climb even higher to get up there. But also, when they get to the other side, that's too high to bomb accurately. They need to be lower to bomb. So it really is a problem, this cloud. And that's what stopped it the day before and on previous occasions. It's the height, not just the visibility, but the height of the cloud. And daylight precision bombing, we keep saying it, your lead bombardier needs to look through his northern bomb sight and be able to see a ground reference and see the target to release. Even though you've got your radar pathfinder with you, ideally you want the bombardier to be able to see the target. So that's a problem.
So soon after getting the go-ahead, we're already in a go-no-go situation.
Yes, so with the situation as it was, the 1st Air Division recalled their aircraft and they began to turn back and return to their bases. But the 3rd Air Division continued on. They were going to continue on for the fight. They continued to cross. They dealt with the conditions that they were faced with and continued to press towards Germany.
So, Mike, what form did this recall take?
Oh, it's a radio transmission, so breaking radio silence. And the 1st Air Division get theirs quite clearly and react as a division, and all their formations turn around and go back squadron by squadron, bomb group by bomb group. The 3rd Air Division carry on longer. In the end, though, elements of the 3rd Division start to peel off one by one as well. And Colonel Mumford, who's commanding the 95th and leading the wing, he decides that they're going to crack on anyway and push on to the target.
So did the 95th hear the recall, or did they disobey the recall? What's the story?
It's interesting because there are lots of veteran witness accounts of these moments, surrounding this, and there's some controversy because obviously there was an order because the 1st Air Division turned back and elements of the 3rd went back. But there's also some of the veterans at the time in the 3rd Division said that the transmission was a German fake transmission. There's a conspiracy theory one. The other one is that Mumford decided to just press onto the target because the weather was so bad, it was equally bad for the Germans, and he was fed up with it being postponed and cancelled, etc., that they would be such a small formation they would carry on. My own view, I don't know what Sophie thinks, my own view is that the fact that 8th Air Force Headquarters realised that this small formation of aircraft had pressed on, and the fact that they allocated fighters to carry on and escort them into Berlin says to me that Mumford made the decision, he carried on and pressed on. I think there was a recall order for the 1st Division, definitely, that's documented. And I think there was a recall order for the 3rd Division. However, discrepancy was given to group commanders to do what they saw fit. And Mumford decided that he'd do what he saw fit. To quote him, "We will carry on to the assigned target."
Sophie, what are your thoughts?
I think my thoughts are probably just about the same. I suppose it's probably a little bit biased being 95th through and through, but knowing the men that run this group, knowing the track record that they had earned for themselves up until this point, I think they probably felt that they were the right people for the job and they weren't going to turn back. You know, they're up, they're ready to go, you know, so they might as well crack on with the job and get it done and be the first ones to do it as well, probably helped with that matter as well.
So another example then of their bravery and steely determination.
Oh yeah, definitely. They'd already got 2 unit citations. You know, anyone in that position, you know, they knew that they were leading the formation for this. So if they carried on, it was going to be really good for morale if they could smash this target and be the ones to lead that formation.
So on that, it's interesting when we listen to the bombardier on the Pathfinder aircraft from the 482nd, who's a guy called Marshall Thixton, and he wrote, "On we flew, courageously, brave and scared as hell."
And it would have been scary as hell. It would also rely on having fighter escort.
It would. And Mumford doesn't know that the fighters are going to be there. He's pressed on. The rest of the raid has turned back. And he's pressed on with his tiny force. And he can't communicate with any fighter escort. So he's pressed on anyway. He's oblivious to the fact he's just going to go on. He's got his own problems to deal with. The bomb bay on his aircraft is frozen solid. It's minus 55 Fahrenheit, which is at minus 48 Celsius when they're flying that day. And there's all kinds of problems with freezing. And one of the problems for Mumford himself is his bomb bay doors are frozen shut. So, and his is the lead aircraft. So everyone's waiting for his bomb bay doors to open, to know to open theirs, and for his bombs to drop, because he's got the lead bombardier, then they'll drop their bombs. So he manages to contact the 482nd Pathfinder aircraft and says, you need to fly next to me in the formation so that if I lose visibility with my Norden bomb sight, then you'll do it by radar, and we will fire a flare from our aircraft, which is obviously in the orders before the mission. And when that flare fires, everyone else will know to drop their bombs. So he's got a lot going on in that aircraft as he's going along with his crew doing all the things they've got to do to coordinate the rest of the combat box behind him, and 100th are following on behind them.
The fighters, though, the fighter escort, they did miraculously turn up.
They did, and what a group of fighters to have. I mean, it's the 4th Fighter Group, who were the Eagle Squadron originally, had flown Spitfires with the RAF, etc., led by Colonel Don Blakesley, the Debden Eagles, who were probably the top-scoring fighter squadron in the 8th Air Force at the time, and also the 357th from Leiston in Suffolk. They're there as well. So two separate groups of about 20-plus fighters, P-51s, who really do get in amongst the German fighters that have appeared over Berlin and hold them off. A very small number, actually, relatively speaking. And the Germans lose 11 fighters in the ensuing dogfight. The Americans record 24 losses that day, but a lot of those are due to bad weather. 11 of them are from the 4th Fighter Group and the 357th. One guy of interest who's making his debut that day is Lieutenant Charles Chuck Yeager, who's flying a P-51 with the 357th on his first ever mission. So imagine that being on your first mission. It's Berlin, and he gets a kill. He gets his first kill. So it's a big day for him.
And Mike, fighter escort was fundamental to the success of a bombing mission into the heart of Germany.
Especially over Berlin, and the survivors of the raid said it was like seeing the cavalry coming over the hill. These P-51s are coming out of the really bad overcast and the cloud, driving off any German fighters that were nearby and allowing this meagre force of 32 B-17s to get to the target, bomb the German capital in daylight, and to get back and get home again. And if they hadn't have been there, who knows what might have happened. I mean, the 95th did lose 4 aircraft that day, with many of those guys surviving becoming POWs, but they had hit Berlin in daylight.
Let's leave the airfield then and go back to the commanding officer's office at the museum and discuss the raid and its impact.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
You're listening to the Mighty Eighth podcast, a podcast about the people, planes, and the places of the United States 8th Army Air Force during World War II. We're talking about the first American daylight bombing raid over Berlin, and we've come now to the commanding officer's office at the museum. Sophie, this is the office of Colonel David T. McKnight.
He flew many missions with the 95th. He was commanding officer of one of our squadrons to start with. And as he rose through the ranks, he ended up becoming the air operations officer. And that's sort of where he finalized and where he sort of found his fame. He continued on and stayed with the US Air Force for quite a number of years after the war as well. So, you know, his career didn't stop with the 95th. He continued on long after that.
And if we look around, we can see his desk. It looks almost as though he's just walked out of the room. There's a cigar, some cigarettes in the ashtray. There's a copy of the Saturday Evening Post dated May 16th, 1942, with the headline Hitler's U-Boat Espionage. And on the desk over here, we've got a map of the UK and Europe showing a few of the targets of the 95th Bomb Group, including Kiel, Regensburg, and indeed Berlin. Sophie, we've described this raid as a milestone mission. The long flight back from Berlin, though, after bombs away, would have given the air crew time to think. Had they been right to press ahead, or had they disobeyed or deliberately ignored the recall?
Yes, so upon their return, they had a welcoming party waiting for them. I suppose when you land your B-17, you taxi it round to the hard standing. Those of them that had to probably taxi past the control tower might have seen the homage waiting for them, possibly wondering whether they were going to get a slap on the wrist for continuing with the mission, or whether they were going to have a big party celebrating what they had done. And in fact, it was the latter that they were waiting for them for. Instead of reprimanding Colonel Mumford, as some had probably worried that that's what was going to happen, in fact, he was actually awarded the Silver Star. He was lead pilot, so that's what he was given. And the Distinguished Flying Cross was also given to some of the other members. And obviously the third presidential unit citation that we are famous for.
Mike, the 8th Air Force needed a big win at this point.
They did. I mean, after the winter of 43 and all the bad weather and delays, etc., with Black Week behind them, big week, and now looking at Overlord, they did need that big win. But also, they really had proved it could be done, and they would continue to prove it could be done after this. And it was compared to the Doolittle raid. The raid on Tokyo showed the Japanese at the end was nigh, really, that they were not unreachable, that the US Army Air Force would punch your way through and could hit your capital in broad daylight. And in fact, it was Jimmy Doolittle who came down to present that Silver Star to Mumford to make that point. And again, rightly, the 95th get a lot of credit for doing what they did. And Mumford himself personally should also as well, because that was it. It had been done, and they would return again on the 6th of March and again after that. And Hermann Göring had made his famous quote about Call Me Meyer about bombing the Ruhr. But he also said that after the war, when he was waiting for trial at Nuremberg, that when he saw P-51s over Berlin, he knew the jig was up. And the 4th Fighter Group and 357th overhead, and from then onwards, lots of other fighters overhead, single-engine fighters that could reach right into the heart of the German Reich and escort bombers over the capital. Really, that was the beginning of the end for the Luftwaffe and for the Third Reich.
So not only air superiority, air supremacy.
Yes, air superiority is time limited. Air supremacy is all of the time. And that would come. But this is the first step, you know, bombing the seat of power at will whenever you wanted to, weather permitting was really important. And it sent a clear signal to the Allies themselves and to across Germany that the end was nigh.
Not only then a strategic victory, but a massive, massive PR coup, a propaganda win too.
Yes, and it couldn't be denied. You can put as much propaganda out as you want, but when your civilian population can see aircraft with white stars flying overhead of the capital, they know that what you're telling them is a lie. And let's just put this in another context. This is almost exactly 2 years after Ira Eaker and his recce party arrived in England with no aircraft and less than a dozen people. 2 years later, American bombers are hitting the German capital by day and the Royal Air Force are hitting the German capital by night. And Ira Eaker's round-the-clock bombing had become a reality for Berlin.
A huge psychological victory then. And Sophie, this paved the way for D-Day, the invasion of Europe by the Allies and eventually the march towards Berlin itself on land.
Yeah, and definitely this was, you know, it was on the front cover of every newspaper in, you know, of all the Allied countries the next day, you know, that this raid had taken place. A huge boost for morale of, you know, all the Allied forces. I suppose, you know, the top brass knew what was coming in the next few months and the preparation for D-Day itself. And I suppose just knowing that we'd managed to hit Berlin from the air, you know, the next target was to hit Berlin from the ground. And that was, you know, the paving way forward after that was their main target. Let's reach Berlin. Let's broach those gates into Germany and defeat them from both angles.
And Mike, your final thoughts?
Yeah, Sophie mentioned the newspapers, the Allied newspapers. It's interesting to read what the German newspapers said, and Goering made statements that just a few Allied aircraft overhead in daylight doesn't mean anything really, but that would be rammed down his throat in the coming weeks and months as more and more larger formations hit Berlin by day and the RAF continue to pound by night.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Mighty Eighth podcast. Another episode about the people, planes and the places of the United States 8th Army Air Force during World War II. Thank you so much to the Red Feather Club for welcoming us here to Horam. And thank you so much to special podcast guest Sophie Green for showing us around. You've enjoyed yourself, Sophie, yeah?
Oh, yes, very much so. Any time spent here is a good day. So,
well, we hope to be back soon and hope to come to one of your dance evenings. If you've enjoyed listening to this episode of the Mighty Eighth podcast, please remember to listen, like and subscribe to all the other episodes wherever you listen to your podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify and Google. Do check out our website at mighty8thpodcast.com and check out the show notes page to email us or get in touch via social media. We'd love to hear from you. We'll be back soon with some more stories about the United States 8th Army Air Force during World War II. But for now, thank you so much for listening. I'm Johan Tasker, goodbye.
And I'm Mike Peters, goodbye.